From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogeau, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, author of the best-selling series of mock Victorian novels for children, A Series of Unfortunate Events, featuring the orphans Violet, Klaus, and Sonny Baudelaire. His new book is the unauthorized biography of Lemony Snicket. Also, the singer once known as the First Lady of Las Vegas, an interview with Keeley Smith. She was the wife and singing partner of Louis Prima. She has a new Best Of compilation. Also, film critic John Powers reviews the new film Insomnia. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin have signed an arms reduction treaty that will require each side to cut its deployed strategic nuclear warheads by about two-thirds over the next 10 years. NPR's Don Gagne says President Bush called for a new relationship between the two nations.
The president said that the U.S. and Russia no longer need to be targeting one another with nuclear weapons. He said there are still some vestiges from the Cold War, but he said it's not in the U.S. strategic plan to be thinking about Russia as an enemy. He said these two countries are now friends. He says this treaty solidifies that, and he says the way to move forward now is by finding ways to create partnerships, economic partnerships, partnerships when it comes to developing energy and energy supplies, partnerships in terms of fighting terrorism around the world. Those are the ways that he wants to see the future U.S.-Russian relationship defined.
NPR's Don Gagne in Moscow. The Roman Catholic Archbishop of Milwaukee is planning to make a public apology for any stress caused to the church when he revealed that he had paid to settle a sexual assault accusation against him. A spokesman for Archbishop Rembert Weakland said the time and place for the apology hasn't yet been determined. Weakland resigned from his post effective today. He acknowledged yesterday that he had paid a settlement of $450,000 to a man who accused him of an attempted sexual assault that allegedly took place 22 years ago. The district attorney in Milwaukee said he may ask for a special prosecutor to investigate where the archbishop obtained the money for the settlement. Americans are beginning the long holiday weekend as the government issues several vague warnings about the possibility of another terrorist attack. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The warnings have come in different forms, and officials caution that none of the threats is specific or confirmed. The Department of Transportation has advised operators of subway and rail systems about intelligence that an attack on subway trains could be under consideration. A DOT spokesman said there's no information about a specific attack planned or a specific time and place. He called it more of a let's be careful out there reminder than anything else. The FBI has also told state and local law enforcement agencies that terrorists may be trying to acquire the ability to use scuba divers to carry out an attack within the United States. Vice President Dick Cheney also told Naval Academy graduates in Annapolis that there's no doubt terrorists want to strike the United States again. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 111 points, or 1%, to close at 10,104 in light trading. For the week, the Dow was down 249 points. The Nasdaq lost 36 points today. This is NPR News. The Pentagon says U.S. and coalition troops in Afghanistan captured about 50 people in a raid on what was believed to be a Taliban and al-Qaeda hideout. Marine General Peter Pace said that no American or coalition soldiers were hurt in the action, which left one person dead and two injured. A U.S. military spokesman in Afghanistan said the coalition troops returned fire when they entered the compound west of Kandahar today. After months of silence, Catholic Church officials in Miami are now admitting that seven priests have been suspended since 1998 because of allegations of sexual abuse, and four others have taken early retirement. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
Officials at the Archdiocese of Miami did not identify the suspended priests in a statement released to the Miami Herald yesterday. As recently as last month, Archbishop John C. Favarola denied the Archdiocese had a problem. But a spate of recent lawsuits are now accusing several local priests of sexual abuse dating back to the 70s. Most involve teenage boys, though one lawsuit accuses a Fort Lauderdale area priest of sexually assaulting two women. The Archdiocese says it is cooperating with county prosecutors and has already turned over to them information regarding the Fort Lauderdale area cases. There are currently 430 priests in the Archdiocese, which serves more than 800,000 Catholics in a region stretching from Key West up to Palm Beach. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
U.S. officials are expressing disappointment over Pakistan's decision to begin missile testing. Pakistan announced this weekend's tests in the midst of a tense standoff with India over the disputed state of Kashmir. Secretary of State Colin Powell spoke to officials from both sides this week in an effort to reduce tensions. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Our guest today is the author of 8 best-selling mock Victorian novels for children. They tell the tales of 3 unlucky orphans who lead lives filled with misery and woe as they are constantly on the run from a repulsive and treacherous villain and endure terrible accidents, itchy clothing, and bad singing. These novels are collectively known as A Series of Unfortunate Events. They're written by Lemony Snicket, the pen name of Daniel Handler. Handler, a.k.a. Snicket, has a new book, Lemony Snicket, The Unauthorized Autobiography, a mishmash of memos, news clippings, photos, and even musical scores concerning the series and its alarmingly elusive author. When Terry spoke with Daniel Handler last December, they started with a reading from the first Lemony Snicket book, The Bad Beginning, which begins, as Snicket often does, with a warning to his readers.
If you are interested in stories with happy endings, you would be better off reading some other book. In this book, not only is there no happy ending, there is no happy beginning and very few happy things in the middle. This is because not very many happy things happened in the lives of the 3 Baudelaire youngsters. Violet, Klaus, and Sonny Baudelaire were intelligent children, and they were charming and resourceful and had pleasant facial features, but they were extremely unlucky, and most everything that happened to them was rife with misfortune, misery, and despair. I am sorry to tell you this, but that is how the story goes.
A little further into the story, we find out that the Baudelaires' parents just perished in a fire that also destroyed their home, and so their endless misfortunes begin. Now, your book, as we heard, starts with a warning that readers might be better off with a more cheerful book. Why did you decide to start your book that way?
Well, it seemed only fair to warn anyone who was seeking cheerfulness. And also, when I sat down to start writing for children, I really had no bearing in children's literature. I hadn't read a book for children since I was a youngster. But I remembered this overwhelmingly moralistic tone in all of my least favorite books. So I thought it might be good to sort of mock that from the outset and warn children away from the story instead of the sort of typical treacly beginning, which is, you know, this is a very charming story and you're just going to love the adorable hero.
What are some of the terrible things that have happened to these orphans?
Oh, well, I mean, it's such a depressing list. I hate to think of drivers listening to NPR driving off the road as I list them off. I mean, they meet Count Olaf, who is a distant relative who is only after the fortune that their parents have left behind. He's a terrible person who tries to marry the eldest Baudelaire, Violet, and locks up the baby in a birdcage and dangles it outside of his tower window. They go to stay with their kindly Uncle Monty, who's murdered. They go to stay with their Aunt Josephine, who throws herself out of a window, or at least so it appears. They're forced to work in a lumber mill. They go to school. That's always a terrible thing. They stay with rich people and find themselves falling down an elevator shaft. They're driven out of town by an angry mob with torches and barking dogs. And then in the most recent volume, they find themselves prepared for unnecessary surgery in the hospital. So it's really quite a cornucopia of terrible things.
There's a lot of literary jokes, like little in-references that only adult readers would get, or at least teenage readers. You know, like the orphans are named the Baudelaire children. Their first names are Klaus and Sonny, two of them. You want to name some of the other little references?
Well, they're cared for by Mr. Poe. At one point they fall into the household of Jerome and Esme Squalor, who are named after J.D. Salinger's story for Esme with Love and Squalor. They attend Prufrock Preparatory School after the poem by T.S. Eliot. Yeah, they're pretty much surrounded by the world of books. I liked the idea of a universe that was governed entirely by books. The Baudelaires find the solutions, or what appear to be the solutions to their problems, in libraries in each volume. And so there's sort of some heavy-handed, or I hope mock heavy-handed, propaganda saying that all of life's difficulties can be solved within the pages of the right book.
Well, another thing you do in your books is you use kind of big words, and then you define them for your readers. Let me read an example. This comes from the last page of your first Lemony Snicket book. And the sentence is, "The car drove farther and farther away until Justice Strauss was merely a speck in the darkness. And it seemed to the children that they were moving in an aberrant," the word aberrant here means very, very wrong and causing much grief, "into an aberrant direction." Tell me how you developed that approach to taking a big word that may be above the reading level of your readers, and then managing to humorously define it within the sentence.
Well, it wasn't really as artificial as that. I mean, I just like a lot of words, and I wanted to put them in these books. And as I was writing them when I was writing the first book, it would occur to me that maybe aberrant was a word that wasn't known to many third graders. And so then it seemed to fit right into this mock moralizing tone that the narrator would stop often at very, very suspenseful moments and define the word in a way that was hopelessly bound to that individual context. And so it makes me very happy to know that that now, I mean, there's sort of millions of fourth graders who know what the word ersatz means, and that's or know what the expression casing the joint or understand dramatic irony. That really excites me. So I don't sit around pedagogically and think, well, what can I teach the little nippers? But I just love these words, and I just wanted to put them in my books. There are not enough books that have the word corpulent, in my opinion.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Handler, and he writes under the name Lemony Snicket. It's a series of novels geared at young readers, but having a really popular audience. Several have been bestsellers, and the series is called A Series of Unfortunate Events. Your new novel is set in Heimlich Hospital. Little Heimlich maneuver joke in there.
Well, I think he's such an unheralded medical phenomenon. It would only seem fair to put him in at least one book.
Why a hospital?
Well, hospitals are really terrifying places, I think, for children and for adults. And they're also places that are so often sanitized in children's literature. There's this sense that children ought not to worry when they go into the hospital. And so there are all these books that say, oh, the hospital's really a fun place and everyone there just wants to make you better and you get to watch TV and eat ice cream all day long and it's really quite a pleasure. And that just seems terrible to me to tell a child that they're not going to have a scary time in the hospital. Of course they're going to have a scary time in the hospital.
Now, there's a group of professionals in your novel whose job it is to cheer up the people in the hospital. And initially, the Baudelaire children hide out in their van, and this is how they end up in the hospital. They're hiding out in this van carrying a group called Volunteers Fighting Disease. And this is a van of people who go to the hospitals to cheer up the sick. And they sing this weird, seemingly cheerful song. Would you recite the song that you wrote for them to sing?
Yes, of course. "We are volunteers fighting disease, and we're cheerful all day long. If someone said that we were sad, that person would be wrong. We visit people who are sick and try to make them smile, even if their noses bleed or if they cough up bile. And the chorus is, tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon. We visit people who are ill and try to make them laugh, even when the doctor says he must saw them in half. We sing and sing all night and day, and then we sing some more. We sing to boys with broken bones and girls whose throats are sore. Tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon. We sing to men with measles and to women with the flu, and if you breathe in deadly germs, we'll probably sing to you. Tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon.
What do you think of the song? How would you feel if this song were sung to you?
Well, I think I would have that that same annoyed feeling that I always feel if I'm surrounded by people who are singing to me in order to cheer me up. I mean, I think every child and adult knows the horror of it, of going to a restaurant and having it turn out to be the sort of restaurant where everybody stands around and sings happy birthday. And it's that same dread that I tried to capture in those lyrics.
I'd like to hear an example of a song that you do like, so I thought I'd ask you to do this. Stephen Merritt, who is with the group Magnetic Fields and is probably best known for his CDs, 69 Love Songs, which is 69 songs in every imaginable genre of love songs, and some of them are straight songs and some of them are parodies of love songs. Anyways, he...
And some of them are decorated with accordion played by myself.
Uh-huh. And you and he are old friends. You wrote the liner notes for his CD, and he's writing a series of songs to accompany the audio versions of your books. Mm-hmm. So perhaps you can sing unaccompanied one of those songs?
Certainly. This is the song that he composed that I perform when I'm usually in front of an audience of children. And usually I'm accompanying myself on the accordion, but today will be a cappella due to some accordion-related trouble. The Count has an eye on his ankle and lives in a horrible place. He wants all your money, he's never at all funny, he wants to remove your face. And you might be thinking what a romp this is, but wait till you meet his accomplices. When you see Count Olaf, you're suddenly full of disgust and despair and dismay. In the whole of the soul of Count Olaf, there's no love. When you see Count Olaf, count to zero. Then scream and run away. Scream, scream, scream and run away. Run, 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 or die. Die, 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 die.
Very good. I like that. Did you write the lyric?
Thank you. No, that's Mr. Merritt's invention thoroughly.
But based on your character?
Yes.
So I'm glad you get to sing that at your readings. It goes over well, I assume.
Well, yes, we usually encourage everyone's least favorite thing, audience participation. So during the part where I sing run, everyone runs. And then the part where I sing die, everybody slumps over on the floor. And really, you haven't lived until you're standing in an independent bookstore watching a lot of 8 and 9-year-olds slump over as if dead.
Daniel Handler, speaking with Terry Gross last December. Under the pen name Lemony Snicket, he writes the best-selling children's serial novels A Series of Unfortunate Events. His new book is Lemony Snicket, an unauthorized autobiography. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Now back to Terry's interview with Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. His best-selling series of mock Victorian children's novels is called A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Now, you write your Series of Unfortunate Events novels under the pseudonym of Lemony Snicket. How did you come up with that name?
Well, first off, I should say that I'm not sure pseudonym is exactly right, because the character of Lemony Snicket, this man who speaks directly to the reader and also who is tangentially involved in the stories that he's telling, is really more of a character. We just thought it would be fun to publish the books under the name of this character. But the name Lemony Snicket I actually had lying around before I had any desire to write for children. I was researching the first of two novels that I've published under my own name, the first novel, The Basic Eight, and I needed to contact, for research purposes, some right-wing political organizations and religious groups, and I wanted material mailed to me, but I didn't want to be on their mailing list for obvious reasons. And so someone asked me, "So what is your name?" And I opened my mouth, and out popped the words Lemony Snicket. And it became, among all of my friends then, a joke. We would write letters to the paper and sign them Lemony Snicket, hoping they would be published, and reserve tables in restaurants under the name Lemony Snicket, and all sorts of things like that. And so for a small select group of the population, the idea that the name Lemony Snicket has risen to such notoriety is particularly shocking.
It's a very snidely whiplash-sounding name.
Oh, thank you.
Well, why did you stumble on that? I mean, why not something like, you know,
Terry Gross,
Stephen Jones, or whatever?
I really can't describe it. It was as inexplicable as an epileptic fit, I guess. It just came right out of my mouth. It's since been pointed out that it resembles, of course, the name Jiminy Cricket. Who is exactly the kind of overly moralistic, cheerful narrator who I despise. But it was not on purpose, I hasten to add, in public, to mock the Disney Corporation. But it has since been pointed out to me that the names are a bit rhymey, and it does fill me with delight that there was an inadvertent slap into the face to that overly, just that nasty cricket.
Do you have much merchandising involved with your books?
No, really none as yet. We gave away some Band-Aids for the hostile hospital that said unfortunate event on them. I'm pretty proud of those. And we just had some terrible greeting cards just in time for the holidays, which are available at one of the chain bookstores. Greeting cards that say things like, "Why haven't you called?" And it's all downhill from here.
If people start asking you more about merchandising, is there a place where you would insist on drawing the line, something that you, some kind of typically commercial way of merchandising children's literature that you wouldn't want to be part of?
Well, gosh, it's such a slippery slope. I mean, you know, I always think, well, it would really be horrible to be associated with fast food, but then not too long ago, I had a fantasy that, you know, there would be unhappy meals that would come out of a series of unfortunate events. You know, maybe a little mad cow disease in the burger or just whatever we could do to really make them unsavory. No, I don't know. It's very difficult to say. More and more children write to me or come up to me in bookstores and say, in effect, what else is there that I can buy? And it's sort of it's both a frightening question and an understandable one. And I hope that if there is any merchandise, that it will be the sort of merchandise that that encourages people who buy it to really have fun in their imaginations. I mean, on one hand, a movie like Star Wars seems over-merchandised, but it would really be impossible to overemphasize how much fun I had when I was a kid playing with all the Star Wars characters and making up my own stories, and I think becoming a storyteller rose out of that kind of play. So it's very hard to tell. It's so easy to say, oh, well, I shouldn't have any of my literature sullied by commercial attention. But once you begin to actually think of how people would use what other people want to make, it's also hard to say no.
Have you run into any parents, teachers, or librarians who object to either the tone or the content of your books?
Not nearly as many as I thought I would. I really thought that there would just be an overwhelming wave of outrage. And instead, there have just been a few isolated complaints that I've heard. We were banned in one school district in Decatur, Georgia. I'll always have that. They can't take that away from me.
On what grounds were you banned?
Well, I hate to get too catty about Decatur, Georgia, but they were very concerned in the bad beginning that Count Olaf wants to marry Violet, who is a distant relative. And this strikes me as something that, without being too stereotypical about the South, that perhaps Decatur, Georgia has heard of before, let's just say. And also, I'm at a loss for how to construct a villain who isn't doing villainous things. If Count Olaf were only doing things that no one would object to, then he really wouldn't be much of a villain. So I'm somewhat nonplussed by that kind of criticism that, boy, Count Olaf is sure a terrible person. And so I always have to write back and say, well, yes, yes, he is. he sure is. Let's catch him. and a woman once in Oregon came up to me at a bookstore and said, you know, in one of your books you teach that it is sometimes necessary to lie, and that seems like a very disturbing lesson to me. Can you name one time when it would be absolutely necessary to lie? And I was so happy that the answer came to me right away instead of, you know, as it usually does when people say something to you and then you think 3 days later, oh, that's what I should have said. Instead, it came right away and I was able just to turn to her and say, nice sweater. I'm just really proud of that.
What was her reaction?
I think she said thank you. I'm not sure that the lesson was taught, but at least I was able to sleep at night knowing that I'd been able to say something in response. I mean, of course you have to lie. I can't imagine that you would want to teach your child never to lie under any circumstances. That's not going to serve the child well when the child goes to a birthday party and is forced to say whether or not he or she had a nice time.
Well, Daniel Handler, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, spoke with Terry Gross last December. He's the author of the children's book series called A Series of Unfortunate Events. His new book is Lemony Snicket, an Unauthorized Autobiography. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by PBS, presenting Now with Bill Moyers, a new series that explores the issues shaping our world and changing our lives. Friday night at 9 Eastern on PBS. Local times may vary. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, singer Keeley Smith. She was 16 years old when bandleader Louis Prima discovered her and hired her to be a singer for his band. Later, they married. Smith has a new CD. And John Powers reviews the new film, Insomnia.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Louis Prima discovered Keeley Smith in 1948 when she was just a teenager. He hired her to sing with his band, then married her in 1953. They took their act to Vegas and became one of the most popular lounge acts of the Rat Pack era.
I'm confessing that I love you.
I'm confessing that I love you too, baby.
I'm confessing that I need you.
Honest, I do, baby.
I need you every moment.
In your eyes I read such strange things, baby.
But your lips deny they're true, baby.
Will your answer really change things? Making me blue.
Making me blue.
Making me blue. And I'm afraid someday you're gonna leave me. Said you can't still be friends with me.
If you go, you know you'll grieve me. All my life on you depends. Am I guessing that you love me?
Dreaming dreams of you in vain.
I'm confessing that I love you.
That's Louis Prima and Keeley Smith, recorded in 1960. Their marriage lasted 8 years. They divorced in 1961. Prima died in 1978. Keeley Smith's recent CDs include Keeley Sings Sinatra and Swing, 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 on which she sings several of the songs she and Prima were known for. A collection of her recordings, including some performed with Louis Prima, has just been released on the Veress label. It's called Absolutely the Best of Keeley Smith. And she's been performing this month at the Feinsteins at the Regency. The run concludes tomorrow night. Terry spoke with Keeley Smith 2 years ago.
What was it like to go on the road with Louis Prima when you were 16?
Well, when I left home, my mother had one condition, and that was that I had to travel with Louis and his wife. And Louis had three conditions, and they were you can't smoke or drink or date the musicians, which I wasn't interested in any of that. So it worked out fine. After a few weeks, though, they moved me over to traveling with the musicians. And I must say, they took care of me, they looked out for me, and they were perfect gentlemen. Not one of them hit on me. And it was just, it was a great friendship and camaraderie in that band. He had some really nice men.
Now, did Louis Prima give you any suggestions about your singing?
No. For years, he never said a word to me. And then when we went to Vegas, someone said to him, are you going to send her to a vocal coach? And he said, no. He said, she'll find whatever she needs on stage. And that's, and I sing, actually, Terry, like I talk.
So what about in phrasing and in rhythm? Did you feel like you could just naturally fit in to the kind of swing rhythms that Louis Prima was using?
Well, no. I have to be very honest about that. I've always been known as a ballad singer. And I prefer singing ballads. But when this situation came up, my husband, Bobby Milano, who's also my producer of the record, he said, I think you should go back. We should listen to the old Louis songs and some Louis Jordan things and really pick out some good swing things that haven't been done. And he played Sunny Side of the Street. And he said to me, can you do Louis version? And he said to me, can you do that? I said, sure, I can do that. Well, Terry, I didn't have the faintest idea if I could do it or not. And with a lot of studying and slowing the tape down, I was able to do it. And you know something? I loved it. I loved copying him. I loved the feeling that I got singing it. And it just, I was very happy making the CD.
Grab your coat, your tie, your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep and just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. I can hear the pitter-patter, a happy tune
is your step, and life can be so sweet. On the sunny side, I used to walk in the shade with my blues on parade. But I'm not afraid, 'cause rubber baba baboodle badoide, I ain't got a cent. I feel rich as Rocky Fellow, and gold dust round my feet. Oh, doodle bop bop side, grab your coat, your tie, your hat, your pants, your shoes, your bop doodle bop doodle, baby. Just direct your feet, sonny honey, bada doop, bunny, bada doodle, baby. I can hear the pitter pat, pitter pat, pitter pat.
When you were singing on stage with Louis Prima, the act evolved in such a way so that, you know, he'd be clowning around on stage and scat singing, and you'd stand there perfectly still and you know, occasionally come out and sing a ballad, but you'd even look bored and, you know, you'd be scratching your face. And, I mean, that was part of the act. How did that part of the act evolve? And I should mention, too, sometimes he'd go over to you on stage and try to, like, provoke you into a reaction, and you would just be reactionless, just totally straight-faced.
Well, actually, I scratched because I itched. It was not part of the act. We had very hard water in Las Vegas. And I remember one time we did the Sinatra TV show, and the director came over to Louis, and he said, I want her to scratch her nose at this point. And Louis looked at him, he said, man, she scratches when she itches. and that's the truth. I never scratched unless I itched. As far as the deadpan thing was concerned, that was very accidental. We worked from midnight till 6 in the morning in Las Vegas, and we did 5 shows a night, and the shows were 45 minutes long. For the first half hour, I had nothing to do but stand there. I was not a hand clapper. I wasn't a finger snapper. I was not a moving type of a person. So we had a little tiny upright piano because we were working behind the bar up on a little tiny stage that just barely held all of us. And I just crossed my arms because I didn't know what to do with my hands and stood there. And when we first started, the lounge was wide open. There were no curtains, no windows, no nothing. I could see the people that came in the front door. I could see the people that came in the side door. I could see the people coming out of the big showroom. And I paid attention to what was going on in the casino. I could tell you who came in, who they were with, what they were wearing, almost what time they left. And I was so busy doing what I call being nosy that when Louis would come over and pull on my skirt and I'd turn and I'd look at him, it was like, don't bother me. You're interrupting my thought here. And that's how it happened.
Now, let me ask you, how would it feel when you were singing, you know, a beautiful ballad on stage, and then in the middle or toward the end of the ballad, Prima would come over and start clowning?
It didn't bother me. The people loved it. And you know what? It's really crazy to say this, but when we were very big, I never knew we were very big. I didn't know how big we were until after we broke up. And which is kind of crazy because it shows that I lived in my own little world. But when Louis would do all of his things, I just thought it was wonderful, and it didn't bother me at all.
How could you not know how big you were?
I don't know. I guess just dumb. I don't know.
or isolated.
Well, I was very protected. I never had to make a decision. Louis never made me wear a gown I didn't like or sing a song I didn't like, and that was all I cared about. All the decisions he made pertaining to music, business, whatever. And all I had to do was get up and do my shows and sing. And in the daytime, I spent with my children. So I was very happy.
Maybe all of that was a function of starting with him so young, when you were too young to make big decisions.
Well, I was... I was going to say something, but I'm not going to say that.
Okay.
When we broke up, I didn't know how to talk to people. We were broke. I was broke. I don't know about him, but it was a little tough, you know. And thank God for people like Frank Sinatra and Donna Shore. You know, Donna's the one that got me out of the house after Louis and I divorced. He had convinced me that I'd be nothing without him. And he told me that he'd hire a girl and call her Kelly Smith. and that I should just forget about a career because I was nothing without him. And I believed him. And then Donna called one day about, oh, golly, about 5 or 6 months after we broke up. And she said, I want you to come do my TV show. And I told her, I said, Donna, I can't do that. And she said, yes, you can. You've got to get out of that house. And then Frank was calling, and I was very close with Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy. And they were all wonderful to me, and they got me out of the house. And I went back to work.
Keely Smith speaking with Terry Gross. Her new CD is absolutely the best of Keely Smith. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to our interview with singer Keely Smith.
I think, you know, you were friends with Sinatra and the other members of the, you know, Rat Pack.
Right.
What was it like to hang out with them then when they were the stars of Vegas? You were a star of Vegas, too. I mean, you guys kind of, you know, owned the city in a way in terms of entertainment. What, can you, like, tell a story that would bring to life those days and that crowd?
Well, I think I mentioned before that when they would come in our lounge, they would get up on stage with us. Frank did every time. Sammy did almost every time. Dean did a few times. But I was closer to Frank. And when we would go to his show, I would get up and sing with him. Now, Louie and I didn't, but I would. And then on Monday nights, which was our off night, Frank would call and he'd say to Louis, he said, hey, Chief, they called Louis the Chief. Hey, Chief, why don't you and the Indian come on in? I'm going to have a little cookout tonight or whatever, show a movie. And Louis didn't fly. So Louis would say to me, babe, he said, you go ahead and have a good time, because Louis knew I was really thrilled with meeting all those people. And I'd get on a plane and I'd go into L.A. and Frank would pick me up and we'd go to his house. And there I'd be sitting with Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Kim Novak and all these kind of people, Billy Wilder and Rosalind Russell. And, you know, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. So I did that almost every Monday night for quite a while. And it was a thrill. And then, of course, Frank and Peter and Pat Lawford were my good, good friends. And they kind of looked out for me when I was in there. And they took me all over. And then the next thing I know, Frank asked me to record with him. And I did a couple of duets with him. And then Sammy is an interesting story, because when Louis had the big band in the late 40s, early 50s, we worked the Apollo Theater. And one of the acts on the show was this young kid, the Will Mastin Trio, and that's all it was called in those days. It wasn't even Sammy Davis Jr. And I became friendly with Sammy from then on, and he became like a member of my family. And so I was very involved in what you call the Rat Pack, and I loved it. It was just wonderful.
Were you the shy one in the group?
Mm-hmm. Always. I've just come out of my shell recently. Look, my husband Bobby says that when I was with Louis never let me talk. Now he can't shut me up.
When you started singing with Louis Prima when you were 16, did you think, one day I'm going to marry this man?
Oh, I didn't even like him. No. Oh, goodness, no. Mercy, mercy. No, when we would do tea dances in the summer, he'd wear short sleeves and he'd put his arm around me and he was so hairy, I couldn't stand it. And it used to just drive me crazy when he touched me. And also, I happened to be very close with his wife. I was crazy about his wife, Tracy. And we became the best of friends. And no, I had no inkling whatsoever. As a matter of fact, my mother told me that I was in love with Louis. I didn't even know it.
God, that sounds like a movie.
I know. It's going to be a movie.
What did she tell you when she told you that you really loved him?
I remember exactly where it was. We were standing backstage at the Paramount Theater, and we did like 5 stage shows a day. And At the beginning of each show, I was dressed in my gown, in the high heels, standing in the wings, watching everything he did on stage. And she pulled me aside one day and she said, you know that you're in love with him. I said, no, Mom, no, I'm not. And she said, yes, you are. I said, no, I appreciate him as a performer. And I love watching him from the, you know, from the sidelines. She said, no. She said, you listen to me. You're in love with this man. And she was right. I didn't know it, though.
Well, it must have been really hard when you did become lovers because he was married and you were really close to his wife.
No, it wasn't, because our friendship kind of deteriorated prior to that.
Your friendship with his wife?
Tara, do you have children?
No, I don't.
No. Well, when I was pregnant with my girls, I was the happiest person in the world. I thought there was nothing in the world more beautiful than having a baby, and it showed. It showed in the way I dressed and the way I looked and so forth. And you kind of get a glow when you really want your baby. And Tracy wanted her child, I'm positive of that. But she changed. She changed so drastically that she kind of alienated me. She tried to get me fired from the job, and she didn't succeed in that, but she almost did. And she changed as a wife with Louis. And I guess that is what kind of threw Louis and I together a short time afterwards. You know, it's hard to really put into words exactly when it happened, but that's what happened.
Right. When you divorced in 1961, he married a woman who also became the female singer in his act. Did you find it strange that you seemed to be replaced by a person, you know, in his personal life and in his act?
No. As a matter of fact, she wasn't the first singer. He had about three singers before her.
I see.
And he didn't marry her right away. But a very quick story. One of the singers that he hired, the one he hired right after me, I don't even remember her name. She was a nice girl, and she came up to me one night in a club, and she introduced herself, and she said, I'm the new singer. She said, I just wanted to tell you that I've always admired you. And I thanked her, and she was very sweet. Louis heard about it and fired her. So in those days, I was taboo. Nobody was allowed to talk to me. None of the musicians, you know, it's just like, a complete erasing somebody from your life.
Did you become friends again with Louis Prima before his death?
Yes. As a matter of fact, he asked me to remarry him. And I told him, I said, I love you very much, but I'm not in love with you. And I said, I could work with you if you want. But as far as marriage, that's out of the question. And he had a mild heart attack. And that's when we became really good friends again, mm-hmm. and stayed in contact up until he died.
Keeley Smith spoke with Terry Gross in 2000.
I say either.
And I say either.
I say neither.
And I say neither.
Either.
Either.
Neither.
Neither. Let's call the whole thing off.
I like potato.
And I like potato.
I like tomato.
And I like tomato.
Potato.
Potato.
Tomato.
Tomato.
Let's call the whole thing off. I'm butto. If we call the whole thing off, then we must part.
And oh, if we ever part, then that might break my heart.
So if I like pajamas and you like pajama,
I'll wear pajamas and give up pajamas. For we know we need each other, so we
better call a calling off.
Oh, let's call the whole mess off.
I say house.
And I say house.
I say mouse.
And I say mouse.
House.
House.
Mouse.
Mouse.
Let's call the whole thing off. Oh, I like vanilla.
And I like vanilla.
I sarsaparilla.
And I sarsaparilla.
Vanilla.
Vanilla.
Chocolate.
Strawberry.
Apricot.
Gagoozes.
But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we must part.
And oh, if we ever part, then that might break my heart.
Now if
you go for oysters and I go for oysters.
Why, I'll order oysters and cancel the oysters, for we know we need each other, so we
better call a calling off, all babe.
Oh, let's call the whole thing off.
Keeley Smith with Louis Prima. Smith has a new CD, Absolutely the Best of Keeley Smith. Coming up, a review of the new film Insomnia. This is Fresh Air. Insomnia is a new film based on the 1997 Norwegian film of the same name. The remake stars Oscar winners Al Pacino, Robin Williams, and Hilary Swank. It's directed by Christopher Nolan, who made Memento. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Last year, filmmaker Christopher Nolan surprised the world with Memento, which forced both the audience and its hero to piece together its story as if it were a shattered mirror. The movie became a cult hit, to some an obsession, and its success raised the question of what Nolan could possibly do next. Would he make another offbeat independent movie, or would he, as the saying has it, go Hollywood? Turns out, he's done a bit of both in Insomnia, an enjoyable big-budget remake of a small, creepy Norwegian thriller about a tormented policeman. It stars Al Pacino as Will Dormer, a famous LAPD detective who's been sent with his partner, that's Martin Donovan, to the Alaskan backwater of Nightmute to help solve the murder of a teenage girl. Although he's greeted worshipfully by an eager young cop played by Hilary Swank, who's looser here than she's been since winning her Oscar, Dormer is not a happy man. He's worried about an internal affairs investigation back home and assailed by a sense of comic justice that eats at his liver like a buzzard. His mood only gets bleaker when, staking out a suspect, he makes a terrible mistake with fatal consequences. Trying to cover it up, Dormer suddenly finds himself playing cat and mouse with a psycho named Walter Finch, played by Robin Williams, who, in a touch that recalls Strangers on a Train, insists that they're two of a kind. Dormer isn't buying it, but stewing in guilt and utterly unable to sleep, you see the summer sun shines in Nightmute 23 hours a day, he sinks into a profound exhaustion. The only thing that keeps him going is his dedication to nailing bad guys. Here, he gives the local cops a lesson in how to look at a dead body.
No fibers, flakes, hairs?
We know about forensics work up here. I told you, body gave us nothing.
Oh, she gave us plenty. All this trouble, all this care. Why?
He knew her.
He knows we can connect him to her.
This isn't some random psycho crime of passion?
Yeah, I don't know, maybe. But whatever happened, his reaction to it wasn't passionate. He didn't panic, didn't chop her up or burn her beyond recognition. He just thought about what we would be looking for. And then calmly removed all those traces. No haste, no rush.
Why would he clip the nails after scrubbing them?
Yeah, manipulating the body, prolonging the moment.
No mutilation.
Not this time.
You think there's been others?
No. But there's gonna be. This guy, he crossed the line and he didn't even blink. You don't come back from that.
Although Insomnia comes burnished with a Hollywood sheen, it's careful to preserve what made the Norwegian film worth adapting in the first place, its psychological twists and sense of moral unease. Still, I suspect that fans of Memento may well be disappointed, for this is a very straightforward thriller. No one will feel the need to see this one twice. It's not that Nolan's sold out or been crushed by the studios, but that finally, he's a less distinctive talent than Memento's time gimmicks made him appear. At bottom, he's not so much an idiosyncratic artist like David Lynch as a kindred spirit of director Steven Soderbergh, an old-style Hollywood director with a knack for making entertainments geared to an intelligent audience. In particular, he's terrific with actors. And he needed to be, for the pairing of Al Pacino and Robin Williams could have easily turned into a WWF bout of overacting. After all, both men's default setting is too much. But not here. Nolan wins a memorably melancholy turn from Pacino, that icon of angst, who wanders through the film with the ravaged, vainglorious grandeur of an ancient Roman ruin. His world-weary eyes make insomnia the merest of formalities. The movie also boasts an unexpectedly muted performance from Williams, whose increasingly crumpled face makes Robert Altman's long-ago casting of him as Popeye look positively visionary. As Finch, he's finally figured out how to play normal. He actually appears saner than Dormer. And the great joke is that here he's playing a murderer. Still, the casting is curious. Why hire Robin Williams to play a down-to-earth-seeming guy when hundreds of other actors can do that without breaking a sweat? And if you do cast him as a psycho-killer doppelganger, why not unleash him and get the benefit of his improvisational glee? The answer, I think, is that Insomnia aspires to be more than just fun. For this isn't really a movie about a cop solving a crime. We know who did it early on. It's about a detective who starts out investigating a murder and then winds up confronting his own guilty soul. And in that way, it's a natural follow-up to Memento. Indeed, if you look beyond the glossy production values and the big-name stars, you see that Nolan's still exploring the preoccupations of his earlier film. There's a hero who's in a state of psychological distress. There's the shared guilt of the wicked and the seemingly innocent. And there's the inescapable awareness that the past is often more alive than the present. Nolan never tires of reminding us that memory can be as treacherous as quicksand, which is enough to keep anyone awake at night.
John Powers is executive editor and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Paradise Park by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Will Smith. Men in Black 2 opens this summer, and his film Ali is now out on video and DVD. Also, Bill Russell. He's considered the greatest defensive center in the history of the NBA. Join us for the next Fresh Air.